Good morning. I will call the House Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is Thursday, March 20th, 2025, and I welcome everyone here. May I have a motion to approve the minutes of March 18th? A quorum is present. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of March 18th? Representative, what's your name? Oh my gosh, I'm drawing a blank. Engen moves the minutes of March 18th. Any discussion?
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Engen. Seeing no discussion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The minutes are approved. Our first order of business today is going to be a couple procedural things. Members, with Representative Feist's approval, we will be re-referring House File 104 as amended to the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. And I want to commend Representative Feist for her willingness to work across the aisle and get this bill in a good place so that it can move forward. And with that, Representative Feist, would you like to move to reconsider the final vote taken on House File 104?
Yes, that is my motion, and I appreciate my colleagues across the aisle interested in working with me on this bill and continuing to move it forward. So that is my motion.
Perfect. Thank you. All those in favor of the motion to reconsider the final vote on House File 104, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Oops, too early. Motion prevails. Representative Feist, would you like to move that House File 104 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Policy?
Yes, that is my motion.
Thank you, Representative Feist. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. It's on its way. Thank you, Representative Feist, for all your work on that bill. Our first bill on the agenda is Representative Baker, House File 1379. Welcome to the committee. I hate to cut out. I have a bill to present in the bonding committee. So Vice Chair Hudson's going to come and take over. I regret that I won't be here probably for the passage of your bill, but thank you for bringing it. And I looked over it last night. I like the bill. So. With that, I will turn it over to Representative Hudson, to Vice Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll wait.
I will make the motion to put House File 1379 in front of the committee. And Representative Baker, please go ahead and describe your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Co-Chair Liebling, thank you for having me this morning. I do have an A2 amendment that I also want to present, if I could, members, and I can give it a brief description, and then I'll explain the bill as a whole. What the amendment does, and this actually came up from Chair Liebling.
I'll just move to put the A2 amendment in front of us. Go ahead and describe
it. Thank you. Thank you for that, Mr. Chair. I appreciate Chair Liebling's bringing this to my attention at the last hearing that we had in, I think it was Health. And again, it was just clarifying the importance of why we're here today is about the immunity side of things, but just the emergency situations. But the A2 amendment really just clarifies what emergency situations apply to the patient treatment in hospital settings and settings outside of the hospital. Again, I'm grateful for Representative Liebling's pointing that out to me in the House Health that helps us. The second part of that amendment clarifies immunity for providers who administer an opioid in the circumstances in subdivision 3, paragraph B, to a patient with a non-opioid directive, an emergency, and again, when you can't access a medical record or et cetera. So the amendment, Mr. Chair, really just tightens up the assurance that we're getting this language right, and I would appreciate supporting the amendment to my bill.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Is there any discussion regarding the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adopting the A2 amendment state so by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment is adopted. Representative Baker, to your bill as amended.
Yeah, thanks again, members. As we state, I want to just say how proud I am of what we have done in Minnesota over the last several years when it comes to what we've been trying to do to fight the opioid epidemic. And we should be proud of the work that we've done. I don't think there's a single person in this room that doesn't know someone in their life who has been affected by an opioid addiction in our communities or in our families. Many of us have been personally and forever impacted. The bill that I'm presenting today is one more tool that we can use to help reduce unnecessary opioid use and prevent new addictions before they even get started. The bill establishes a non-opioid directive form, which is just a one-page legal document that a patient can fill out with their provider to be entered into their medical record stating their wishes not to be prescribed or administered an opioid unless medically necessary. The Department of Health would also would create this form for us and make it available to the public online. The form can be revoked by the patient at any time, and providers are not liable if they cannot feasibly access the patient's record at that moment. When there's an emergency situation or a provider determines in their best professional judgment that an opioid is really needed. The Minnesota Medical Association and the Department of Health have been consulted with this and they have no issues with this language. A non-opioid directive is a tool to help patients advocate for themselves and can help facilitate a conversation between a patient and the provider when that can be a little bit awkward, when you don't really know how to talk to your doctor about something. But if it's on the record and it comes up, it might be easier for that provider to sit down and have a conversation. These conversations are important. The directive promotes transparency and communication, supporting a safer and more personalized approach to treatment, and has been successfully implemented in many other states. Members, this is one small, easy way that we can help patients advocate for themselves and further reduce the risk of opioid dependence before it even gets started. In your packets, you will find numerous letters that also support this from other organizations. And I think that's all I have, members. Mr. Chair, I'll take questions. I don't have any testifiers, so I'm happy to take any questions.
There were no testifiers signed up. However, if there are members of the public present who'd like to testify on this bill, now would be the time. Seeing none, we will go to member discussion. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe I missed it in your presentation, but on line 3.19, it talks about immunities, and I think that's probably one of the reasons why it's in front of this committee. Can you just expound on the immunities that you're adding to this, both civil and, well, it says criminal too, but and also personal, professional discipline, disciplinary actions. I wonder if you could just explain that just a little bit.
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Rarick, I think, again, not being a professional in this, I pulled up the immunities clause, the 145C.11 state language here. This is similar to the other healthcare provider agreements and or the directives that they have. I believe it follows into those same type of things. This directive and its immunities match what we have in other current statute for other health directives. Again, I might need to ask for some nonpartisan if you're looking for more detail on that, Representative Rarick. So that I is about the extent of my knowledge about that certain part of the bill.
Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. in our brief, it has a little bit, the section of statute that you referenced, so 145C.17, that's where it's being amended. Maybe nonpartisan could just talk about if it's kind of mirroring other places in statute of doing immunities.
Thank you, Representative Rarick. Would nonpartisan, perhaps Mr. Hopkins, have anything to add on that point?
Mr. Chair and members, so not a section, not a chapter of statute I'm intimately familiar with, but the language in the bill does mirror the immunity section in section 145C.11, which is existing law.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. And Representative Rarick is satisfied. Chair Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I had the same kind of questions, and maybe I could just ask Mr. Hopkins again, you know, understanding this isn't maybe your particular area of expertise, but so my question really is if you have one of these non-opioid directives versus if you just have an indication in your medical chart, say, you know, doing this the other way, say that there's an indication in your chart that you shouldn't be given opioids. is the immunity of the practitioner the same, whether you have this with this form or without the form, or are we actually changing, is the form going to change the immunity for the practitioner for making some kind of mistake and giving the opioid when they shouldn't?
Mr. Hopkins.
Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, so the immunities provision specifically references having that non-opioid directive. So you have to have, the immunity is for if the person prescribes or administers an opioid to a person who actually has a non-opioid directive. They are immune from criminal prosecution, civil liability, or professional disciplinary action for that behavior.
Chair Liebling.
Well, Mr. Hopkins, thanks for that, but it doesn't really answer my question. I mean, it says in the bill that they have this immunity if the act or failure to act was performed reasonably and in good faith. So clearly, I think that means if they were negligent, they could still be sued for negligence. If they, you know, I guess I'm still really wondering, you know, right now, without this bill, I think a person could go to their practitioner and say, hey, I never want you to give me an opioid. Put it in my medical record. And it could be put in the person's medical record. And then if an accident occurred of some kind and they were given the opioid when they shouldn't have been, presumably some standard of liability applies to that practitioner. This is all without this bill. Now, with this bill, I realize that the language in the bill here only applies to this procedure, that's this new procedure that Representative Baker is proposing. But what I'm wondering is, does the practitioner have the same immunity for doing the wrong thing with opioids with and without the form? I mean, I think there's a, let me just say kind of as an aside, there's a reason to do the form anyway. I'm not saying there's no reason to do the form. I like the bill, Representative Baker. I'm just trying to understand what we're doing here with liability, which is the purview of this committee.
Mr. Hopkins, do you have a follow-up on that? No? Representative Baker, do you have any comments?
No, Mr. Chair and members, I think what we're trying to get to is, earlier again, if you have a conversation with your provider to say, look, I don't want to ever have an opioid if at all possible, it's providing that maybe this tool of a one-pager that makes it a little bit less awkward for that person to have a conversation with a doctor, but yet the outcome is still on the record. I think that's what some of the intent is here to do. I also know that I don't want to get this wrong. And this is also has been, since I've been here for 10 years, the toughest committee to work with because I got to get it right. And I appreciate the work that you do here because I want to make sure that we don't make it harder for providers to do their job. I don't want to make it awkward for anybody to say we missed something here. So I have always appreciated this committee, and I'm glad Chair Scott didn't hear me say that. It would go to her head. So anyway, but I appreciate these questions. I think that the one page is just providing another tool to communicate with her providers and others that will look at their record at some point to make it a little bit easier to do.
Yeah, Mr. Chair,
if I may. Chair Liebling.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that. And I'm not sure what that says about the other committees, Representative Baker. But,
like they do, yeah.
But anyway, no, I totally get what you're saying. It's a tool, and I think it's a good idea. I'm just, I think it doesn't really change the immunity that exists outside of the form. That's what I would like to think anyway. And I guess I want a little bit of reassurance from that because, you know, I think using the tool should not change the immunity of the practitioner for, you know, if they act reasonably and in good faith. I think that's pretty much the standard for if it would happen outside of using the tool, because clearly people should be able to say to their practitioner, don't give me opioids, put that in my medical records, and that should mean something too. And so I just want to understand that a little better, but I'm certainly not opposed to the bill, but I hope if we can't really get a clear answer on that today, I hope that you'll, you know, I'd like, I know we want to advance the bill, but I hope that we can stay in conversation about that, just because I don't want it to be confusing. I don't want this to have a impose a different standard of liability than if you don't use the form. Thank you.
Yeah.
We have anybody? Any other member discussion?
She agrees with me.
Okay. You guys are having your own form of communication. It's all good. It's all good. Seeing no further member discussion, Representative Baker, closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, appreciate the conversation. I think you're right as well, Co-Chair Liebling. The intent is not to change anything. It just provides another step in a way to get to the same outcome. The liabilities and the immunities should be the same either way. So I will continue to work on this to make sure that everybody's comfortable with this as it moves forward. It's an important part of our opioid conversation here in the state of Minnesota, and I appreciate the deep dive that we've done here today too, just to make sure that we get the language exactly the way we need it. So I'll do that. And with that, members, I appreciate your support today.
Thank you, Representative Baker, Chair Baker. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Hudson renews his motion that House File 1379, as amended, be recommended be re-referred to the Committee on Health, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Baker.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Curran. Welcome to the committee. House File 2260 is before us. Representative Curran, would you like to move that your bill be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy?
Thank you, Chair. That is my motion.
Thank you. We have the bill before us. Representative Curran, I see we have an A1 amendment. Would you describe that amendment, and then we will move it?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. The A1 is largely technical changes and this House file in general. This is a clone of Chair Schumacher's House File 2115. That is the greater DHS policy bill. It's customary that we break that bill down into the committee jurisdictions, and so that's what you have before us today in House File 2260. And so the A1 is like I said, largely technical amendments and also incorporates amendments that were adopted in Chair Schumacher's bill in Human Services.
All right. I will move the A1, and the A1 is before us. Any member discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. To your bill, Representative Curran.
Thank you again, Chair and committee members. Like I said, House File 2260 is the judiciary portions of the overall DHS policy bill, so these will come back together as we continue our work this session. And so with that, I can kick it over to our testifier.
Perfect. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and continue on with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ari Didion, Legislative Director for the DHS Office of Inspector General. House File 2260, as Representative Curran said, is a clone of portions of the DHS policy bill. These are provisions from that bill that needed to be before this committee. I appreciate Chair Scott, Chair Liebling, hearing our bill today, and appreciate Representative Curran authoring our bill. The underlying bill, as introduced, contains three proposals. There's a background studies, clarifying, and technical proposal, and there's just a handful of clarifying changes, and this is sections 3, 4, and 5, as well as the newly added section 31 in the amendment. These provisions add greater transparency about the background studies process. It updates some of the investigative and arrest data that we were able to access. And then it also extends the scope of a limited set-aside that is already available for personal care provider organizations to similar provider types. And then Section 31, which was added in the amendment, is a clarifying change to changes to 245C passed last session, just updating the effective date. We had the wrong effective date in there last year. This bill also contains the anti-kickback proposal. What this anti-kickback proposal does is it prohibits kickbacks in the medical assistance and child care assistance programs. For medical assistance, this is already in federal Medicaid law, so this is mirroring that federal law and adding that to state law. And for CCAP, there is no federal anti-kickback law, but we based the CCAP anti-kickback proposal on what some other states have put in place. There are, I think, at least 36 other states have added criminal penalties for kickbacks, and so we think this is just a really important program integrity provision, and it would give DHS, as well as our law enforcement partners, more tools when investigating and prosecuting fraud and misuse in human services programs. And that is sections 1, 2, 6, 7, and 9, as well as the newly added section in the amendment, section 19. The bill also contains a proposal related to personal data protection for human services judges. In 2024, chapter 480.40 was created, which establishes some personal data protection for judicial officials, including folks in the Office of Administrative Hearings, but the human services judges at DHS were not included. So this just adds those human services judges who are very similar to the administrative law judges to this chapter, and then is Section 8 of the bill. And then there was quite a bit added in the amendment, so I will just run through all of those really quick. There was a couple of changes related to direct care and treatment. I won't be able to get into these in any depth, but my colleagues from DCT are here if folks have deep questions. Sections 1, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 28, 29, and 30 relate to a proposal to update the county liability for the cost of care for competency attainment restoration services and provides clarity in statute that DCT can bill counties for these services. Sections 3, 4, and 5 in the amendment are also related to DCT. These are clarifying changes related to sections added to Chapter 611 in 2023, which addressed competency proceedings and clarifies, and these provisions clarify DCT's ability to share data for the purposes of patient care. The newly added Section 3 also contains a second change to Chapter 13.46, Subdivision 3, on line 8.18. There's also a clarification about DHS's ability to share when we have issued a payment withhold against a provider. This is permissive language. It does not require us to share that information, but it allows us to do so, which we think is an important transparency provision about the types of actions that we are taking to address fraud and misuse in our programs. Sections 8, 10, 11, and 12 are from the governor's fraud package. These expand DHS's ability to take action when entities or individuals are convicted of fraud or theft in state or federal programs. Section 9 is also from the governor's fraud package. This improves DHS's ability to exchange data with other state agencies for the purposes of investigating fraud and misuse. Section 15 is also from the governor's fraud package. This creates a background studies disqualification from positions of management and billing based on violations of DHS and DCYF program integrity statute. Section 17 relates to a proposal from our Behavioral Health Administration. And this transfers all eligibility determinations for the Behavioral Health Fund from counties to DHS. For tribal nations that determine eligibility for the Behavioral Health Fund, they will not be affected by this. They will still have the ability to determine eligibility for tribal members. Section 19 is related to the anti-kickback proposal. This just adds the prohibition on kickbacks to 256B medical assistance statute to make it very clear that this is not just a crime, but also an administrative disqualification. And then finally, Section 31 added in the amendment is just a clarifying change to the change to 245C that was passed last year. And I will stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Didion. I appreciate your thorough going through that amendment. It was a pretty lengthy amendment, so I'm glad you took the time to walk us through it. There's some important provisions in there. In light of what happened in the courts yesterday with Feeding Our Future, those folks are being held accountable. But this will hopefully put some pieces into law so that it prevents those sorts of situations from happening. And the sharing, you know, if we've got a bad actor in one program, the ability to let other programs know that to flag it is really an important piece. So we'll go to member questions. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Curran. I agree with the crux of what this bill is trying to address. One of the questions that I have, perhaps it's for your testifier, it wasn't but a couple of months ago that I got a random email from somebody within kind of this realm within DHS and behavioral health. And they were alleging that there are potential folks within DHS who work outside with their own LLCs that help navigate the eligibility path for some behavioral health programs. And so that to me would look and appear to be some sort of a conflict of interest or a form of a kickback from employees within the department itself. Could you give me any further information, or is this not... is this something you're not aware of?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Engen, I'm not familiar. However, I do know that anyone who works on grants in the Behavioral Health Administration or anywhere at DHS is required to fill out conflict of interest disclosures. And if there is a real or perceived conflict, then actions are taken to make sure that that is mitigated. I am not able to speak, I think, a little any more deeply on that because I am not in the Behavioral Health Administration.
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that information. I know that we wouldn't typically expect people engaging in a form of corruption, self-service, or fraud to report that on themselves in every scenario. So maybe we can talk offline and see if there's something that we could incorporate to close up those loopholes, but I appreciate your work on this again.
Thank you. Before we go to Representative Hudson, was there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify to this bill? Please come forward. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. My name is Christy Grum, and I'm with the Department of Human Services. So it's my understanding that there were some questions in this committee about the provisions maybe related to human services judges and the privacy protections that this bill would afford those judges. And so I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that provision, in particular talk about an incident that one of our human services judges experienced. So I'll defer to you, Madam Chair, if you would like me to go into that.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Crum. And I was speaking with Representative Curran before committee started, and we were talking about that provision. I understand, is it 25 or 35 of those judges within across the state? Is it 35?
Madam Chair, I believe it's 35 human services judges that we have at the Department of Human Services that would be integrated into the current requirement in law.
Thank you, Ms. Graham. I think I got your name wrong initially. And then Ms. Graum. Okay. All right. We'll try to get it right, Ms. Graum. Further, I believe there was one of those human services judges had to be displaced from their home due to some threats and different things from the public. If you could elaborate on that and any other threats that these people are getting. There's a lot of folks around in the public sphere that are asking for these protections, and we want to make sure we're not just opening the floodgates. So,
absolutely, Madam Chair. So yes, we have seen an increase in violent threats against our human services judges. And I think I just want to clarify for the committee that our human services judges are essentially administrative law judges, just in a different place in the state. They're in DHS versus the Office of Administrative Hearings. So the current requirement in law covers administrative law judges, but we just wanted to clarify, because ours are a little bit different in statute, that our judges would be covered. I think between like the beginning of maybe the United States having judges and 1979, there was like one violent threat or issue with judges, and that was related to a duel. But since then, we've seen a lot more threats. And in particular, last year, we had a human services judge who had some really violent threats that they incurred, and their family had to be relocated outside of their home for several days. That was a decision made by the Minnesota State Patrol, trying to keep them safe. It was extremely disruptive and really scary and traumatic for the family. They had children, they had pets, they had to inform their neighbors and their daughter's school what was happening. Their daughter wasn't able to go to recess because this was a very scary time. So I do have a statement from that judge that I could read, but I just wanted to share that experience with the committee, because it's just one of the real life experiences that we see that kind of closing what we think is just a loophole with the intent of the underlying legislation would, you know, improve our safety for our judges.
Thank you, Ms. Graum. And why don't you stay at the table in case we have further member questions on that topic. We'll move to Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this wasn't going to be the subject of my original comment, but just to piggyback on that, it's been a recurring topic of people who are in positions of public service coming under threat from various folks outside, and I'm glad we're taking some action on that, and there's more work to do on that front. The comment that I did want to make was specifically in regards to the kickback provisions. Representative Rarick and myself sit on the Fraud Prevention and State Government Accountability Committee, and it was quite a perplexing moment on at least a couple of occasions where this topic came up of federal law being out of alignment with state law when it comes back to kickbacks. And it remains our position that the agency has the authority, as expressed in a previous OLA report, to take action in those scenarios. But getting it codified in this matter is definitely progress in the right direction. So thank you, Representative Curran, for bringing this bill.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. Any other member comments? All right, seeing none, thank you for being here to the testifiers. I'm glad we're getting to the bottom of some of this fraud, and Representative Schumacher carrying the bigger bill, as well as Representative Curran here today. With that, Representative Curran renews her motion that House File 2260 as amended be recommended to be I forgot to give you final comments. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you, chairs and committee members. I appreciate your support.
Perfect. All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Curran renews the motion that House File 2260 as amended be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, same sign. Bill is on its way. Thank you, Representative Curran. All right, next we're going to go back. I believe, is Representative Acom in the room? Not here yet? Oh, okay. Chair Liebling, you want to present your bill? Thank you. Representative Liebling has a bill for us today. It's House File 1429. And the motion would be that it be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Representative Liebling or Chair Liebling, would you like to move House File 1429?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I would move House File 1429 to be re-referred to the General Register, and then I would like to move the A2 amendment that just cleans up some of the language.
Okay, perfect. The A2 is before us. Is there any, can you tell us a little bit about what the amendment does, Chair Liebling?
Surely. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, members, the bill comes from Mr. Drucker's Office of Addiction and Recovery, and it's been through the Health Committee, and it's really a data bill. And as I looked at the language of the bill, I thought it was a little bit confusing and not very specific, because the idea is to share, well, and Mr. Drucker is going to speak to it, I'm definitely not the expert on this, but the idea is to use some data to help fight the opioid epidemic, and we don't want to be transferring individual data, this private data, but they do need certain data. And so the language, as I was reading the language of the bill and as it moved through health, I really thought that it just needed to be written in a little clearer, more specific language so that people knew exactly what data we were going to be transferring. So that's what the bill, what the amendment does, Madam Chair.
Perfect, Chair Liebling. I appreciate that. Any discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Chair Liebling, any other opening comments for the bill, or do you want to go to the testifiers?
I think I turn it over to my testifiers, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Thank you.
Perfect. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeremy Drucker. I'm the Director of the Office of Addiction and Recovery, and I'm testifying today on a bill right now that's going to help us better address the opioid epidemic by sharing already collected data with a national database that helps us track overdose deaths by zip code. So right now, our data on opioid overdoses isn't really timely enough to catch overdose spikes as they happen, but when we do have real solid, real-time data, we can spot patterns, like if there's a bad or a specifically dangerous batch of drugs out there, and public health and safety officials can then act quickly to share that information, distribute naloxone, alert law enforcement, and take other steps needed to save lives. So what this bill does is, so there's 27 other states already that are sharing data from emergency medical services with a website called ODMAP. This makes overdose response more effective because it improves the data quality, and it also saves local law enforcement time that they no longer need to manually enter data into this ODMAP system. And so ODMAP is a national database. It's maintained by the Maryland and Baltimore HIDA department or HIDA board. HIDA is a DEA-sponsored board that consists of local, state, and federal law enforcement officials that are really targeted at high-intensity drug trafficking areas. So this is a government-maintained website. It's a place where 27 other states share data, and it really tracks overdose deaths by zip code. So when we see those spikes, we can really identify those quickly, get that information to our local public health and law enforcement leaders, and then take whatever necessary action we might need to take. So specifically what this bill does is it allows the sharing of de-identified EMS data with ODMAP. That data is limited to things like location, time, what substances were involved, naloxone administration, and whether it was a fatal or non-fatal overdose. Importantly, no information about specific individuals is shared, and the amendment that Chair Liebling brought really helps clarify and be explicit about what data we are sharing so we can ensure that individual privacy is protected. I would also add that only authorized and verified users like first responders, law enforcement, and public health officials have access to ODMAP. Their roles are closely managed, so they only see the information that they need. So again, this is protected information that is not just being given out to anyone, but you really have to have a need to know. on that location data, I would say that I would just add that while location data is shared, the system masks the exact location to, again, mitigate the chance of identifying someone in a smaller community. So it gives you just enough information to sort of understand spatially where something is, but not enough to really identify who an individual might be. I have Mr. Dylan Ferguson with us as well from EMS, who can help answer any questions related to the EMS portion, but happy to stand for any questions.
And to the other testifier, were you wishing to speak or just only here for questions? If you have something to say, please.
Chair Scott, Dylan Ferguson, Director for the Minnesota Office of Emergency Medical Services. I'll just go on record saying that, you know, we support this bill. We think that this will also increase reporting to ODMAP and provide additional resources for public health and public safety authorities throughout the state. Happy to support this bill and happy to take any technical questions related to the EMS data.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to testify relating to this bill? Mr. Neumeister, please come to the table and share your thoughts.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. I've been a long-time privacy advocate in my hat I wear sometimes. I wasn't going to comment on the bill, but when I heard the testifier, just some clarifying questions that I was interested in. What is where and when defined as spatially? Because many overdoses happen in also rural areas. In one county, you know, you can really get an idea of where the person happened, where the incident happened. And one of the things in some material, that in general, with these kinds of databases on a national basis, it comes to where a great number of people have access to it, but as this committee is familiar with, and as Chair Liebling and as Chair Scott, you are familiar with, is then how do you make sure that the data is being used appropriately? So those are just some of the questions. You know, you come down to, I don't know what nationally they do audibly, and the state, as you know, we keep close tabs to make sure that on Minnesotans is used appropriately. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's my two cents.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. And Mr. Drucker or Mr. Ferguson, I've never used, obviously, this database application. How granular does it get with the location? I mean, we're talking in rural Minnesota or any rural state, I mean, rural area of the country. You may have somebody that lives outside of town by 20 miles, and there's no other home close to that home where an incident may have happened for 10, 20 miles. So how do you protect those very rural homes where these occurrences may happen?
Thank you for the question, Chair Scott. And as it relates to our best understanding, the way that location data is shared is through an API that utilizes latitude and longitude based on an incident point, so they don't receive a physical address. That latitude, longitude, which can typically go any upwards of typically 12 to 16 decimal places, I believe in the latest iteration of data agreements was limited to 4 decimal places for both the latitude and the longitude. Additionally, in those more rural areas, it's typically not displayed as a singular incident point, Chair Scott, but rather demonstrated as a heat map, if you will. So if there's one incidence there, you know, there may be a circle or some other type of shape identifying an area. However, you know, particularly rural areas where there are limited other identifying structures, you know, in an area, that is certainly a concern. But that is also why that information is protected, why that information is restricted, and why ODMAP is built comply with the Federal Health Insurance Portability Accountability Act from the federal government. So they have taken every step that they can to minimize those impacts and to try to create it as and keep that it de-identified as to the exact location as possible. Chair Scott.
Thank you. So I'm not sure I completely understood all the decimal points and the longitude and latitude and how that would exactly work in one of those rural situations like I gave you as an example. can you give us like in terms of a quarter of a mile or a mile, or can you put it in, you know, those terms, because I really don't know that much about latitude and longitude and decimal points when it comes to this location stuff.
Completely understand, Chair Scott, and that is a completely fair point. I'm familiar with the technical aspects of how the data that we presently house within the Office of EMS would be transmitted. Let me see if I can find a quick answer to your question, but if I can't, I certainly can follow up with you or ensure that there's some additional follow-up that takes place after this hearing.
Right. I would appreciate that. And what kind of safeguards does this OD map have for role-based access? If either one of the testifiers could speak to that.
Chair Scott, when you say rural-based access, I'm just trying to understand the question. What safeguard?
Role-based access, so that just not anybody can access this information.
Sure. Okay. Understood. Yeah. So only the data is limited. So you have to be an authorized and verified user by ODMAP, and we can follow up with exactly what those steps are to achieve that authorization and verification. But you have to be either a first responder, law enforcement, public health official, something of that ilk.
Okay. Thank you. And then is there some way that ODMAP keeps track of who has accessed the data?
Yes.
Chair Scott. There are maintained audit records of who has accessed the system and specifically what data has been queried, just as we would expect out of any other type of HIPAA or other healthcare-related data application.
Okay. And then would someone that – let's take one of these, the rural example. If they suspect that they're the subject, like that it's – on the map, it's pretty much could be no other house but that particular house. Would those folks have the ability to query ODMAP and find out if they were indeed, if it was identifiable that it was their house?
Chair Scott, members of the committee, I don't believe so. Unless they were a verified user already, they wouldn't have access to the database.
All right. Mr. Ferguson, did you have another answer to one of my questions?
Chair Scott. I was prepared to deliver the same answer that that you just heard.
Okay, perfect. Any other member questions on this bill? All right, seeing none. Chair Liebling renews the motion that House Chair Liebling, I always forget to give the author the last word. Go ahead.
That's quite all right. No, I'm really glad for this hearing, glad for this conversation. Thank you for hearing the bill. And I know I learned something more every time I hear more about it. So thank you for the good questions. And I'll just ask members to this seems to be another really good tool in fighting the opioid epidemic, which we know is so critical. And so I hope we can pass this and make good use of the tool to actually help our folks.
Right. Thank you, Chair Liebling. And I was just listening to you can hear the Wall Street Journal updates. You know, you can click on the little mic or the little headphones and listen to an article, and there's some new combination of an opioid out there. They're always popping up, and so you have a lot to keep up with this situation. So seeing no further questions, Chair Liebling renews the motion that House File 1429 as amended be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. The bill is adopted. I believe I saw, yes, Representative Acom is in the House. So we welcome you to the committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
Representative Akam is going to be presenting House File 1596. And let's see, I will move House File 1596 be recommended to be re-referred to the Committee on Elections, Finance, and Government Operations. It looks like there's an A1 amendment, an author's amendment. So I will move the A1 amendment. It is before us. Representative Akam, can you tell us about the A1?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thanks for the opportunity to be with you this morning. The A1 amendment is kind of a clarifying amendment, and the statutes are designed by how members are appointed to the Met Council. And so the 16 members of the Met Council are considered under, I guess the statute is 473.123 subdivision 3, and the chair is considered under subdivision 4. And so this is just clarifying that they are appointed in separately.
Perfect, thank you. Any discussion on the A1? Seeing none, all those in favor of the adoption of the A1, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The A1 is adopted. Tell us about your bill, Representative Akam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is what could be described as a good government bill. And really what it's doing is making public officials, making the members of the Met Council and leadership staff part of, defined as public officials. And therefore, then under the public data, certain information would be available on their employment, so name, job title, and so forth, which is listed here in the bill. And so it's just bringing them into this category as far as making their employment information public.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Shetnin, welcome to our committee. And I believe you have a few words for us, so go ahead and introduce yourself for the tape and go on with your testimony.
I do, Madam Chair and members. My name is Judd Shetnin. I'm the Government Affairs Director at the Met Council. And this is the first time I've ever been to the Judiciary Civil Law Committee in the 25 years that I've represented the Met Council.
So well, we are kind and gentle with all new people.
Yes.
Sort of.
So thank you for having me. Thank you to Representative Akam for carrying this initiative of the Council. To provide a little context on this, we had a situation last year where we had an employee who was who resigned, and there was a question about whether or not that person's information was public or not, and whether or not they were a public official. And there were a number of requests for data. Turns out that that person was not a public official, so we weren't able to share that. However, then we were looking deeper into this and recognizing that the Government Data Practices Act, there are certain requirements for agency heads, board members, assistant commissioners, that level of staff that the Met Council was not subject to. And so to make sure that we are being accountable and transparent, we're actually bringing this bill forward to ask the legislature to include the council similarly to the way that other government officials are treated in that particular statute. And so just to give you a little bit more context, that would include the Met Council chair, it would include our regional administrator, our deputy regional administrator, our 16 council members, and then the executive directors of our major divisions, which is Metro Transit, our Community Development Division, Environmental Services, which is our Wastewater Utility Planning Division, and then Metropolitan Transportation Services, which does the regional planning for transportation, and then oversees Metro Mobility and some of the other type of programs at the Met Council. So we're here to ask the legislature to include us, and so this was a loophole that I guess we didn't recognize, and so we just would ask that you look fondly on this bill.
Well, you're going to have to twist my arm.
Yeah.
No, I want all agencies listening today to see this as an example of kind of self-governance and self-policing. So I'm very thankful for the bill today. So thank you for bringing it, Representative Acom and Mr. Shetland, for wanting to have transparency at your agency. We do have one testifier. I believe Mr. Neumeister wishes to testify on this bill. Please state your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister, and in celebration of Sunshine Week of 2025, I am wearing yellow. I'm wearing my hat of Sunshine Open Government hat. I applaud Representative Acom, who I've met for the first time just today, and Judge Shutton and the Met Council for bringing this bill. When I heard about it, I went to Ryan O'Connor, and I went to people who were asking for the data and says, what's the issue? Shouldn't it be public? Well, then they were saying, well, the Met Council is a public authority and a local political subdivision. And blah. So then what happened, this came along. I was talking to them last summer. But this is important because what the bill does, you got to take a look. This bill came. And again, someone who's been around, I can tell you at least, give you some context, and I think it's important. In 1995, a number of state heads all of a sudden resigned when they were being investigated for a personal violation of rules or policies. Senator John Marty, we all know, is a good guy, and I've worked a lot with him, he said, that's wrong. The public should know if someone's resigned. So if you look at the bill, and you'll see those sections on lines 225 through number 3. That was put in 1995. It just shows you this is a bipartisan thing historically. Then, in 2012, in Burnsville, the superintendent or someone, I remember, got like a 250, at least a fair amount of a payout as part of a settlement in the middle of an investigation. Myself and, then it was called Minkoji, but with Don Gemberling, who we approached some people and said, hey, shouldn't this concept apply to local people? And that's why you'll see it's a local and why more information about when. And you did good work a few weeks ago, because if you go further up on the bill, you'll see that you passed and deleted the caps, which is in this bill for smaller cities and smaller counties. So we're celebrating Sunshine Week. and then we continue on to here. But I want to leave you at least with one point. That's why I went to the continuation of how we came to this law, is that there are many other public authorities that have been created over the years that are out there and still have the same impact as local political subdivisions and state agencies do. So I encourage you or someone to take that among themselves to maybe, that might be a good, interesting interim project to take a look to bring all those public authorities where a director has a lot of money and are doing a lot of things and intertwining with our lives, and you may want to have them on that same par as what we're doing here. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for the few moments of your time, and happy Sunshine Week.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member questions? Representative Rarick.
I'm sorry, Chair Rarick. Either works. At least you didn't say O'Neill, so that's,
yes,
we're stepping forward. We're stepping forward. So my question is, I see the list of who's included, but who's not included? So you have on your little one-pager that additional executive positions. Does this encompass all of the executive positions within the Met Council? Are there some that are not in this list? Like, who's not on the list? I can see who is, but who's not on the list?
Mr. Chetland.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Rarick. I believe it is all the executive directors that we have at the council, so I think that they are covered. The way that the bill was drafted was to be as close to how state agency heads and associate heads or deputy administrators are included. And so that is how I believe the language is written and what our intention was. So if you're below an executive director, I don't believe, or a division director, that you are not included.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so that's in line with other state agencies.
Mr. Shannon.
Madam Chair and Chair Rarick, I think that that is where the council ends up being a little different, because we are a political subdivision. We are a public corporation, and so we were doing our best to make sure that we were aligning with how the state currently has this applied to agency heads and deputy commissioners, as well as board members. And so that is the spirit of this bill, is to not include other. The spirit of the bill is to be treat the council the same way that the state agency heads and local government folks are treated in this bill. So I can't tell you exactly who isn't covered, but I can tell you who is. Our regional administrator is basically our chief of staff. Our deputy regional administrator oversees the activities of our regional administration. Then you've got our division heads at Metro Transit, again, our wastewater utility at Metropolitan Environmental Services, Metropolitan Transportation Services. These are the directors. These are the folks that under the council basically do the work directed by the chair and by the Met Council. So I believe that we are meeting that spirit.
Chair Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that's good. I would like to see an organizational chart. I'm sure you don't have one with you, but if you could email me the organizational chart just so I can verify that. Yep. Thank you.
Mr. Shetton.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Rarick. Any other member questions? Seeing none.
Madam Chair.
Sorry. Yes.
I would like to add, and I apologize for interrupting, we do include our chief of police, who is not a director, and then our office of OEEO as well. And those are not executive directors, but they are included in this. That was some of the area that was created some of this in the first place. So we wanted to make sure that that was included. So I apologize.
No, that's all right. Thank you. Thank you for adding that. Chair Akam, would you like to have any closing comments?
In honor of Sunshine Week, I urge your support. Thank you.
Perfect. All right. Seeing no further discussion, I renew my motion that House File 1596, as amended, be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Elections, Finance, and Government Operations. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The bill is adopted. Thank you, as amended. Members, we're adjourned.